passers-by. No murderer was seen, yet the corpses of the dead were more than the eyes could discern. Pastoral places had been turned into a sepulchre for men, and human habitations had become places of refuge for wild beasts, and these evils happened to the Romans only, and within Italy alone. Once the plague had died away, empty lands were left for the taking, and the Lombard king Alboin set his sights on them. The territory in Pannonia had not been enough for his people. Their numbers had grown, in part because he had conquered both of the neighbouring tribes, the Heruls and the Gepids. Paul the Deacon tells us that he killed the Gepid king in battle, married his daughter by force, and made a drinking goblet out of his head, a throwback to a much more ancient warrior custom. Now the Lombards numbered over 250,000, and they needed more space. By 568, Lombards were crossing en masse into Italy. In 569, Alboin and his Lombard warriors conquered Milan and began to storm southward. The Byzantine territory in central Italy fell quickly. Only the southern coasts and a strip of land from Ravenna down the coast, cutting across to Rome, where the Pope, Benedict I, claimed the protection of the Byzantine Emperor, remained in Byzantine hands. Italy had changed hands once again. Meanwhile, the Visigothic king Leovigild, brother and successor to Athanagild, had come to the throne of Hispania and was busy reconquering the land his predecessor had lost. Justin II was unable to organize a decent defense, let alone retake the disputed land. The Byzantine attempt to claim the old Roman lands had ended. Author's note: the Byzantine hold on patches of land in Italy would persist for centuries, with the relationships of the Byzantine loyal cities to the throne at Constantinople growing more and more complex, but the empire would never again dominate the peninsula. East of Constantinople, the Persian Khosrew was having exactly the opposite experience. His conquests to the east, he had destroyed the Hephthalites some years earlier, had brought Persia to a high watermark of power. Author's note: the high watermark applies to the medieval Persian Empire, often known as Sasanian Persia, to distinguish it from the ancient Persian Empire, which lay in the same general area but lost its independence to Alexander the Great. Persia did not regain its existence as an independent kingdom until a man from the Sasanian clan declared himself Ardashir, emperor of a revived Persia, in AD 224. Khosrew reorganized the now vast expanse of his land, dividing it into quadrants and placing a military commander over each. The far eastern land won from the Hephthalites, the central area of the kingdom, the lands to the west near the Byzantine border, and the southern Arabian territories. In 570, Khosrew was presented with the opportunity to expand his hold over those Arabian lands. The kingdom of Aksum was planning to cross the Red Sea and attack the Arabian city of Mecca. Once again, the attack would take the form of a religious crusade. The king of Aksum, Abraha, was Christian, and Mecca was the center of traditional Arabic religion. It was also vulnerable. There was no king in Mecca, no one able to organize and lead an effective defense. Arabs were loyal to the tribe of their birth. It was their ethical center, which meant that loyalty did not extend outside of tribal boundaries. Raiding another tribe for food, animals, and women was a constant that bore no stigma of moral wrong. It was a dry land of ever-colliding micro-nations. Mecca itself was governed by a council made up of heads of the leading families, all of whom had equal authority. The convention that no one was to draw a weapon in the sacred territory of the Kaaba was the only acknowledgement that some greater force might bind the tribes together. There was no common law, no central authority, no acknowledged war leader. Even the strongest tribe in Mecca, the Quraysh, was divided, with three clans within it struggling for dominance. Abraha of Aksum assembled not only his armies and ships, but also at least one elephant, the first time this beast had ever been used in Arabian warfare. He moved his forces across the Red Sea and prepared to lay siege to Mecca. But before he could bring the city down, his forces were felled by plague, and he was forced to withdraw. His failure in the year of the elephant appears in the Quran, half a century later, as an intervention of God. "Didn't you see how your Lord treated the troops with the elephant? Did not God foil their strategy, sending against them flocks of birds, pelting them with rock-hard clay, making them like stubble of grain that's been consumed?" Swords had played little part in the defeat. Hoping to avoid a repeat attack, the tribes of southern Arabia asked Khosrew for aid. In 575, he came south with both foot soldiers and a fleet of ships into the land Abraha had hoped to conquer. The Persian intervention halted Abraha's attempts to organize a second invasion. There was no chance now that Christianity would spread eastward into the Arabian Peninsula. Mecca would not be converted. The Quraysh tribe would continue to worship at the Kaaba, and the children of the Quraysh tribe, including a six-year-old boy, later known simply as Muhammad, would not grow up under the cross. Justin II made no effort to challenge Khosrew's meddling in Arabian politics. In fact, he appears to have been losing his mind. John of Ephesus says that he used to bite people when he was angry with them, and that he was only soothed when his courtiers let him sit in a little wagon and pulled him around the palace in it. It had been a long time since the empire had suffered from an insane emperor. For decades, the throne had been held by the fit and the shrewd. Justin's wife Sophia, niece of the legendary Theodora, convinced Justin to name the able courtier Tiberius to be his Caesar. Justin II agreed, and until the emperor died in 578, she and Tiberius controlled the empire together. After Justin's funeral, Tiberius was crowned emperor. Sophia offered to marry him if he would divorce his wife, but he declined. In 579, 1 year later, Khosrew of Persia died after a 48-year reign. Despite his abandonment of the Mazdakite creed, Khosrew had worked hard to make his empire just. The later historian Al-Tabari, eulogizing him, lists Khosrew's reforms. Children with questioned paternity must nevertheless be given their fair inheritance. Women, married against their will, could choose to leave their husband if they wished. Convicted thieves should make restitution, not merely suffer punishment. Widows and orphans must be provided for by relatives and by the state. He had also conquered new territory and equipped Persia with a strong infrastructure of canals and irrigation conduits, rebuilt bridges and restored villages, well-maintained roads and well-trained tax officials and administrators, and a strong army. But the deaths of the two great emperors, Justinian and Khosrew, closed an era for both empires. Byzantium had already begun a downward slide. Whether Persia could remain strong without its great king at the helm remained to be seen. Chapter 34. The Mayors of the Palaces. Between 558 and 656, the lands of the Franks divide into three realms, and the Merovingian kings slowly give up their power. By 558, the four-way rule of the Franks had once again become a single kingship. Illness and murder had removed three of Clovis's heirs, and the last surviving son, Clothar I, now ruled, like his father, as king of all the Franks. The second unification of all the Franks under one crown lasted exactly 3 years. In 561, Clothar came down with a high fever in the middle of a hunt. He died not long after a half-century reign, and left the crown to all four of his surviving sons. His struggle against his own brothers had not convinced him to name a single heir. The old ideals of the Frankish warrior chiefs survived. The king should earn his spurs, not merely inherit them. Clothar had won his crown by outlasting, outwitting, and outfighting his brothers, and none of his four sons would get a free pass into the high kingship of the Franks. The four brothers realized that they were in competition, and from the day of their father's death they behaved, not as joint rulers, but as separate kings of neighboring and sometimes hostile states. When the second oldest brother, Charibert, died in 567, the three remaining kings seized his territory, and the Frankish kingdom assumed a three-way division that would dictate its politics for the next century. The northern territory, ruled by Sigebert, was known as Austrasia. Its capital was originally the city of Rheims, but Sigebert moved his seat to Metz, closer to the border, to guard against the invasions of wandering Avars. Guntram ruled over Burgundy, which had been folded into the Frankish territory some years before. Chilperic controlled the central and southern Frankish lands, a territory known as Neustria, which contained the cities of Soissons and Paris. Burgundy was the minor of the three kingdoms. Neustria and Austrasia were almost equal in land and in strength. Both Chilperic of Neustria and Sigebert of Austrasia had an eye on the high king's seat. Sigebert decided to up his chances by making a match with the Visigothic princess Brunhilde, daughter of King Athanagild. Athanagild agreed to the marriage and sent Brunhilde from her home in Hispania, along with a large dowry. When he heard of the match, Chilperic of Neustria realized that his brother had pulled ahead of him in the power race. Although he already had a number of wives, Gregory of Tours writes, he sent to ask for the hand of Galswintha, the sister of Brunhilde. He also promised that he would put all his other wives away if King Athanagild would agree to the match. The king of the Visigoths must have thought he had hit the jackpot. He sent Galswintha off after her sister, and when she arrived at the court of Chilperic, he kept his promise and honoured her as his only wife. He loved her very dearly, Gregory writes deadpan, for she had brought a large dowry with her. But Galswintha soon discovered that her husband was actually still very much in love with one of his previous wives, a woman named Fredegund, who, in spite of having been formally put away, still showed up in the royal bedchamber on a regular basis. She complained, he insisted, she asked to go home, he refused, and finally, one morning, she was found strangled in bed. The court poet, Bonantius Fortunatus, who wrote the lament over her death, had to choose his words with great care. He describes the marriage, and then goes straight from life to death without pausing to describe the hows and whys. Enjoying for so short a time the binding relationship with her husband, he explains with tact, she was snatched away by death at the start of her life. Both her husband, Chilperic, and her rival Fredegund were suspected of doing the snatching, or at least of arranging it. There was no proof, even though Chilperic now brought Fredegund back to court as his queen, and both escaped without penalty. But Brunhilde, now Queen of Austrasia, never forgave or forgot the murder of her sister. 7 years of inconclusive war followed, with none of the brothers managing to make significant gains on the others. Chilperic and Sigebert were always enemies, but Guntram, with his smaller territory, changed allegiances back and forth, depending on who seemed less likely to try and kill him. Finally, in 575, Fredegund, now Queen of Neustria, sent two assassins to kill Sigebert in his palace. They pretended to be traitors from Chilperic's court, willing to change sides and recognize Sigebert as king. But when they got into Sigebert's presence, they attacked him with poisoned scrammus axes, long Scandinavian knives, normally used not as weapons, but as eating tools. Sigebert died in agony when the poison did its work, leaving his 5-year-old son Childebert II as his heir, and his wife Brunhilde as regent. Brunhilde now had double reason to hate her sister-in-law. Fredegund, she believed, was responsible for the deaths of both her sister and her husband. She took good care of her son's realm. She convinced his uncle Guntram, who was childless, to adopt the boy as his own. This made young Childebert II both the king of Austrasia and the heir of Burgundy, and would allow him to combine the two realms after Guntram's death. She also supervised the day-to-day administration of Austrasia. Brunhilde turned out to be a thoroughly competent ruler, so much so that the Frankish nobles were annoyed by her. Her force of personality and the Frankish hostility to her survive in the later Germanic epic called the Song of the Nibelungs, in which she is brought from afar, Iceland, in the case of the story, to become the wife of the German king. His friends advise against it. This queen, his friend Siegfried tells him, is a thing of terror. But despite the Frankish hostility to his mother, Childebert II refused to send her away even when he reached his majority. He kept her at court as his adviser. Fredegund, over in Neustria, intended to be just as powerful as her sister-in-law. Chilperic was murdered in 584 by a man with a personal grudge. He had no son, but right after the funeral, Fredegund announced that she was pregnant with her husband's heir. This announcement was greeted with skepticism. In fact, once the baby was born, Guntram, who was normally mild-mannered, his chronicler Fredegar calls him full of goodness, suggested publicly that the child's father was a Frankish courtier, rather than his dead brother. At this, Fredegund rounded up 3 bishops and 300 of the more important leaders. They all swore an oath that King Chilperic of Neustria was the boy's father. Guntram was forced to back off. He was too good a man to go against the word of a bishop, and so he went to Paris for the child's baptism. Fredegund named the little boy Clothar II, after his powerful, putative grandfather, and ruled over Neustria as his regent. In 592, Guntram of Burgundy died and left his part of the Frankish rule to Childebert II of Austrasia, his nephew and adopted son. This meant that Brunhilde was now helping her son to rule over both Austrasia and Burgundy, while Fredegund was acting as regent over Neustria. The Frankish rule had devolved to these two powerful women, the Frankish Fredegund and the Visigothic Brunhilde, who loathed each other with a deep personal hatred, and who had the power to determine the actions of their kingdoms. Neither woman would allow that power to slip from their hands. Brunhilde's son, Childebert II, died in 595. He was only in his mid-twenties, and Brunhilde at once accused Fredegund of poisoning him from a distance. His death, though, put her squarely back in control of the double realm of Austrasia and Burgundy. She became regent for his two young sons, aged 9 and 8, who divided Austrasia and Burgundy between them. Fredegund and her son, Clothar II, immediately tried to seize Paris. This battle, says the Frankish chronicler Fredegar, created great carnage, but didn't accomplish much of anything. The hatred between the queens might have swelled into a full-fledged war that would have destroyed the kingdoms of the Franks, but the following year Fredegund died, and her son began to rule alone. 2 years later, the dead Childebert's older son, Theudebert II of Austrasia, reached the age of 13. He could legally rule alone, and so he kicked his grandmother Brunhilde out to the loud cheers of the Austrasian nobles. The old woman made her way south into Burgundy, hoping to join her younger grandson, Theuderic II, there, but apparently got lost on the way. A poor man found her wandering alone, Fredegar says, and took her, at her request, to Theuderic, who made his grandmother welcome and treated her with ceremony. The Frankish kingdom had once again become three independent, essentially hostile realms. In 599, Clothar II of Austrasia, now a precocious 15, tried to attack his cousins and get their land, but the two brothers decided to form a united front. They combined the armies of Burgundy and Neustria, defeated Clothar II, and took much of his territory away, dividing it among themselves. Burgundy, Brunhilde's new home, was growing in size and strength, and Brunhilde went back to her high-handed ways. The chronicler Fredegar says that she had at least one nobleman accused of treachery and put to death so that she could claim his land for the throne, and also accuses her of plotting the assassinations of various other powerful officials. Theuderic himself, once he turned 13 in 600, was unable to get rid of his grandmother and rule Burgundy on his own. He had welcomed her in. In return, she had attached herself to the power of the throne like a limpet. By the time Theuderic had turned 20, well past the age when a king might be expected to marry and sire an heir, he was still single and still under his grandmother's thumb. Unable to throw her out, reluctant to ask his brother in Austrasia or his cousin in Neustria for aid, he was the youngest of the three, and perhaps was afraid that opening the door to either might end with his losing the throne, he sought a new ally. In 607, he sent an ambassador to Hispania and asked the Visigothic king Witteric for the hand of his daughter Ermenberga. The Visigothic kingdom was at its height, and a Visigothic-Burgundian alliance would have made Burgundy the strongest of the three Frankish kingdoms. But apparently Brunhilde could not bear the thought of losing her position as queen of the court. According to the historian Fredegar, she poisoned him against his bride with her words. Brunhilde was a crafty and resourceful woman, and by the time Ermenberga arrived, Theuderic had lost his taste for the whole project. He never even consummated the marriage, and a year later sent his wife back to her father. Instead, he made an alliance with his cousin Clothar II of Neustria against his brother Theudebert II of Austrasia, and in 612 the joint force attacked Theudebert's army on the edge of the forest of Ardennes. The carnage on both sides was such that in the fighting line there was no room for the slain to fall down, Fredegar's account tells us. They stood upright in their ranks, corpse supporting corpse, as if they still lived. The whole countryside was strewn with their bodies. Theuderic and Clothar marched to Cologne, took Theudebert's treasure, and captured Theudebert. A soldier, Fredegar adds, took Theudebert's young son and heir by the heels and dashed out his brains on a stone. Brunhilde had not forgotten her older grandson's decision to throw her out of his court. She ordered Theuderic to imprison his brother and then had the young king murdered in prison. Theuderic claimed Austrasia as his own, making him joint king of Austrasia and Burgundy, but he died of dysentery less than a year later, still without a legitimate heir. To keep the kingdom from falling into Brunhilde's hands, the two mayors of the palace, Warnaka, mayor for Austrasia, and Rado, mayor for Burgundy, took action. Mayor of the palace was the Frankish title for the king's right-hand man, the official who took care of the royal estates, supervised the other government offices, and generally acted as prime minister and household steward combined. When the king was a child or weak or dead, His mare ran the realm. Neither Vanaka nor Rado wanted to see their domains taken over by Brunhilde, so together they invited Clothar II to invade. In 613, he accepted the invitation and marched in, largely unopposed. He captured his aunt Brunhilde and put her to death in a particularly prolonged fashion. He was boiling with fury against her, writes Fredegar in his chronicle. She was tormented for 3 days with a diversity of tortures, and then on his orders was led through the ranks on a camel. Finally, she was tied by her hair, one arm and one leg, to the tail of an unbroken horse, and she was cut to shreds by its hoofs at the pace it went. Once again, the Franks were under a single rule, that of Clothar II, the only one of the kings who probably had no actual relationship to the royal family. Clothar II began to try to bring some sort of order to the chaotic landscape. In 615, he issued the Edict of Paris, which, among other provisions, promised that the king of the Franks would not try to overrule the authority of the local palaces of Austrasia, Neustria, and Burgundy. The three Frankish kingdoms would be united under Clothar, but there would be no single centralized government, and the offices of mayor would not be combined into one. Instead, each mayor of the palace would continue to administer his own realm. Probably this had been part of the deal made by the mayors Vanaker and Rado. They wanted him in, but not at the expense of their own power. Clothar's invasion got rid of Brunhilde and confirmed the authority of the mayors of the palace. Each now had more authority than under the previous rulers. This authority grew even more entrenched when Clothar agreed, 2 years later, to make the mayor of the palace a lifetime appointment. Now the mayors not only were relatively independent, but also could not be removed from office. Clothar had made a devil's deal. He had the crown of the Franks, but 2/3 of his country was ruled by the mayors, whom he could not get rid of by legal means, who had the authority to legislate for their own realms, and who were now able to act independently of the pesky royal children and aunts who had once controlled them. The 617 decree that gave the mayors power for life began a slow transformation of the mayors into rulers, a transformation that would leave the Merovingian kings of the Franks without much of importance to do. For several decades, the kingdom of the Franks had had 3 mayors, one each in the palaces at Austrasia, Neustria, and Burgundy. Clothar's confirmation of this arrangement had been an attempt to combine the fiercely local nature of Frankish politics with the existence of a high king. But it was not entirely successful. Even with an independent mayor of the palace, the nobles of Austrasia agitated for more independence, particularly from Neustria. Perhaps ancient tribal differences or obscure clan hostilities lay behind the division, but the eastern and western halves of the Frankish kingdom were increasingly likely to insist on the separation of their interests. The western Franks called their land Francia and referred to the eastern half as the Eastland, or Austrasia. In return, the Austrasians refused to yield the title Francia to the west. They insisted on using Neustria, or New Westland, for their counterparts on the other side of the Frankish kingdom. Shortly after 617, Clothar agreed to make his 20-year-old son, Dagobert, ruler of Austrasia, thus giving the Austrasians not only an independent mayor, but an independent king. This provided the Austrasians with their desired separation from Neustria and Burgundy, although the independence of Dagobert's rule was doubly illusory. He was firmly under his father's thumb, and in any case, the real authority in his court was held by his mayor of the palace, one Pippin the Elder. When Clothar died in 629, after a 45-year reign, Dagobert got the chance to exercise some real power. His younger half-brother, Charibert, tried to claim the throne of Neustria, but Dagobert first threatened him into withdrawing to the small territory known as Aquitaine, and then supervised his assassination and claimed the whole kingdom for himself. Now the entire Frankish realm was under one king again, and again the nobles of Austrasia objected. Dagobert, who had once helped to preserve their independence, had become their problem. Dagobert was forced to follow his father's strategy. He made his own 3-year-old son, Sigebert III, king of Austrasia, and once again the mayor of the palace held the real power in the Austrasian realm. The Franks were trying to balance, awkwardly, the power of the king, the rights of a royal family, and the intense desire of the Frankish noblemen, the previous clan chiefs, to rule themselves, and the rule of an infant king under the power of a local mayor of the palace was a workable, if unstable, solution. Dagobert died in 639, and the kingdom remained divided. Sigebert III and his mayor of the palace kept control of Austrasia, and Dagobert's younger son, Clovis II, was crowned king of Neustria and Burgundy, which he ruled with the substantial help of two mayors of the palace, one for each realm. During all of these deaths and coronations, what really mattered was the power of the local mayor in each realm, not which royal son occupied the throne. But even though the post had been designed to preserve independent government in the three realms of the Franks, the mayors were not opposed to consolidating their own power. By 643, when Pippin the Elder died in Austrasia, he had also seized the mayoralties of Burgundy and Neustria. Not only that, he passed them on to his son, Grimoald. The mayors of the palace had not previously been able to inherit their power. They were appointed by the king, but now the mayors were adopting the royal custom of blood succession. Grimoald now convinced the young king of Austrasia, Sigebert III, to adopt Grimoald's own son as his heir. This would have catapulted the mayoralty into the throne room, but unfortunately for Grimoald's ambitions, Sigebert III soon fathered a son of his own. Grimoald refused to be defeated. In 656, after Sigebert III died at an unexpectedly early age, Grimoald mounted a coup and took the throne. He ordered Sigebert's six-year-old heir, Dagobert II, to be tonsured, the top of his head shaved to indicate his intentions to become a priest, a sacred version of mutilation, rendering the user unfit for rule by dedicating him to the service of God, and sent him off to a monastery in England. Then he placed his own son, Childebert the Adopted, on the throne of Austrasia. At this, Clovis II, king of Neustria and Burgundy, authorized an invasion. Clovis's army captured both Grimoald and his son Childebert the Adopted. Both were put to death, and the throne of Austrasia was empty. Rather than bringing the tonsured rightful king, his nephew, back from England, Clovis II allowed his official Ecinwald to declare himself king of the entire realm. Ecinwald also became mayor of the palace for all three palaces simultaneously. The mayors of the Franks, intended to preserve local authority, were themselves becoming a threat to it. Clovis II ruled as king of all the Franks for barely a year before he died. He left three very small sons behind. Two of them were duly coronated as kings of Austrasia and Neustria, while the third was raised in a monastery. But for the next 15 years, the two young kings did almost nothing, while various mayors of the palaces battled for power. Later chroniclers would call these rulers the first of the rois fainéants, the do-nothing kings, and the name clung to the last generations of the Merovingian rule. Chapter 35. Gregory the Great. Between 572 and 604, the Pope negotiates with the Lombards and sends Christian missionaries to Britain. In Italy, currents of personal hatred were also shaping the Lombard kingship. The Lombard king Alboin had folded the Gepids into his realm by force, killing their king and marrying his daughter Rosamond. At a drunken banquet in 572, Alboin handed her the goblet made from her father's skull and, in the words of Paul the Deacon, invited her to drink merrily with her father. Rosamond's simmering hatred boiled over. She blackmailed a court official into assassinating Alboin while the Lombard king slept, first taking the precaution of binding his sword tightly to the head of the bed. Alboin apparently slept with his weapon. Alboin woke up when the assassin entered his room and tried to defend himself with the only furniture in the room, a wooden footstool, but he was killed. Rosamond and her accomplice fled to Ravenna, where the exarch welcomed them, hoping to use them against the Lombards. But the two fugitives poisoned each other not long after arriving in Byzantine territory, and both died on the same day. The essentially Germanic nature of the Lombards now reasserted itself. Alboin had been less a king than a warrior chief. For almost his entire reign, the Lombards had been at war and on the move. After his death, they did without a king for a time. War leaders took control of the army and conquered a series of cities, each warlord establishing his own little kingdom in the Lombard-controlled land. More than 30 of these little kingdoms, later known as duchies, stood side by side, in a period known as the rule of the dukes. In 584, the Lombard dukes decided that their separate kingdoms would benefit from a shared defense. They elected one of their own, the Duke Othari, to oversee Lombard resistance to any invasion. After Othari's death in 590, they chose another man for the same purpose, Agilulf, who was raised to the sovereignty by all at Milan, hoisted up on a shield in the ancient ceremony that gave him a power he was not born to. Two of the dukes declined to recognize Agilulf's overlordship. Both were in the south of Italy, cut off from the main Lombard kingdom by the narrow strip of land still claimed by the Emperor of Constantinople. After a few clashes of arms, as Lombard armies trooped back and forth across the Byzantine land, Agilulf forced both to acknowledge him. After this, the two Lombard kingdoms in the south were known as the Duchy of Spoleto and the Duchy of Benevento. They would continue to act as small independent kingdoms, despite their Lombard allegiance. In the same year as Agilulf's election, Pope Pelagius II died, and the churchmen of Rome chose a successor. They offered the seat of St. Peter to a monk named Gregory, who did not particularly want it. Gregory had been sent to Constantinople 12 years earlier, on a diplomatic mission for the Pope, and had returned from the city to his monastery with great relief. He preferred the abbey to the throne room. By the time Pelagius died, Rome was in sore straits. The Lombards had cut the city off from Ravenna and from Constantinople. The plague made a sweep through the city, and the Tiber flooded so severely that its waters flowed in over the walls of the city and filled great regions in it. The priests of Rome were unanimous. Gregory, who had now risen to the abbot of his monastery, was competent, experienced, and knew how to handle relations with Constantinople. They wanted him to be the next pope. Gregory, dismayed, sent a letter begging the emperor at Constantinople not to confirm the appointment, but the chief official of Rome stole the letter and instead forged another, begging the emperor to make the appointment official as soon as possible. The emperor did so, and Gregory found himself, against his will, raised on the spiritual shield of his fellow churchmen. He took control of the church in Rome, shouldering his burden against his own inclinations. As pope, he was supposed to be the spiritual authority in the city, but since the civil authority of Rome was cut off from easy consultation with its superiors, and since Gregory theoretically had continual communication with God, who was unrestricted by Lombard armies, he found that not only the priests, but also the prefects and officials of Rome turned to him for guidance. "I am now detained in the city of Rome," he wrote to a colleague, "tied by the chains of this dignity." Gregory was a problem solver, a coper. It was not in his nature to turn away appeals for help, but rather to figure out a way to deal with them. The most pressing problems were earthly, not spiritual. The Lombard leader, Agilulf, was moving south towards Rome, anxious to take it from Byzantine control, and the dukes of Spoleto and Benevento were moving west to complete the pincer move. By 593, the Lombard armies were at the walls of Rome. Gregory sent messages to Constantinople, warning the emperor of his peril and begging for help. Tiberius had died in 582, leaving the crown to his hand-chosen successor, his son-in-law Maurice. But the emperor Maurice was dealing with Avar invasions in the northwest and Persian complications to the east. No imperial troops arrived. Neither did any pay for the soldiers remaining in the city. Gregory was on his own. He took matters into his own hands. He paid the troops at Rome out of church funds. "As at Ravenna, the emperor has a paymaster for the first army of Italy," he wrote to Constantinople bitterly, "so at Rome for such purposes am I paymaster," and went out to negotiate with Agilulf on his own authority. He agreed to pay the Lombard king 500 pounds of gold, also from the church treasury, and Agilulf withdrew. Gregory had saved Rome, a feat that even more than his spiritual accomplishments earned him the nickname Gregory the Great. But the exarch at Ravenna, who was theoretically in charge of Byzantine lands in Italy, complained to the emperor Maurice that Gregory had overstepped his authority. Gregory defended his actions. He had no other choice. Furthermore, he wrote, Agilulf was not unreasonable. He would be willing to come to a general peace with all Byzantine territories if only the exarch would agree, for he complains that many acts of violence were committed in his regions, he wrote to Ravenna, and if reasonable grounds for arbitration should be found, he also himself promises to make satisfaction in all ways if any wrong was committed on his side. It is no doubt reasonable to agree to what he asks. But the exarch refused. His pride had been injured, and a standoff with the Lombards lasted until he died in 596 and was replaced by a more reasonable man. The new exarch, Callinicus, agreed to sign a treaty with Agilulf. For a time, peace between the Lombards and the Byzantine territories resulted. Pope Gregory was finally able to turn away from political matters and spend time on his spiritual responsibilities. His commentary on Ezekiel had been interrupted by the Lombard crisis. Now he could go back to writing. And he could also attend to another duty, sending a priest over the water to Britain to take Orthodox Christianity to the peoples there. There had been Christians in Britain before. The Romans of the late empire had been Christian, at least in name, and a few churches had been built. But since the collapse of Roman rule, there had been no organized Christian presence on the island. Churches in the south and east had crumbled as the unconverted Saxons had pushed in. The British churches that remained, mostly in the north and west, had been separated from the Mother Church at Rome for over a century. Gregory took it upon himself to bring the island back into the kingdom of God, which meant evangelizing the Saxons. At the end of the 6th century, Saxons ruled along the eastern coast and in much of the southeast. The descendants of the general Aiele still ruled in Sussex, the kingdom of the South Saxons. Another royal line had established itself in the kingdom for the West Saxons. The descendants of Hengist, leader of one of the original Saxon strike forces, ruled the southern kingdom of Kent, and small kingdoms ruled by Saxons and Angles bracketed the remaining British kingdoms, which still held the west and north of the island. To bring all of these Saxons into the Christian fold, Gregory chose a monk named Augustine, who had served at Gregory's former monastery. Augustine started out with a large band of companions and plenty of supplies, got as far as the coast of the Frankish kingdom, and wilted, seized with craven terror, Bede says. In August of 596, he returned to Rome and asked for permission to abandon the trip. Gregory refused to relinquish the mission. He sent Augustine back to his stalled party with a letter of exhortation. "Let neither the toil of the journey nor the tongues of evil-speaking men deter you," he wrote to them. "May Almighty God grant me to see the fruit of your labor in the eternal country, that so, even though I cannot labor with you, I may be found together with you in the joy of the reward. For in truth I desire to labor." Still trapped in Rome, carrying out his administrative duties with dogged faithfulness, Gregory longed for the healthy fulfillment of the mission field. Augustine's party took heart, crossed the channel, and in early 597 landed on Thanet Island, a tiny isle just off the coast of Kent that fell under the rule of Kent's king, Ethelbert. Probably Augustine had targeted Ethelbert from the beginning. His wife, Bertha, granddaughter of Frankish King Clothar I, was already a Christian. When Ethelbert heard of the party's arrival, he sent a message telling the missionaries to stay put on the island until he could decide what to do with them. Finally, he decided to go and see them, rather than inviting them into his kingdom. He was suspicious, not knowing whether this was a political or spiritual mission. Talking to them, he was reassured and decided that they were harmless. Even Bede, anxious as he is to show the triumph of Christianity, can't make Ethelbert's reaction a dramatic one. After listening to Augustine, the king said, "I cannot forsake the beliefs I have observed, along with the whole English nation, but I will not harm you. And I do not forbid you to preach and convert as many as you can." Eventually, Ethelbert did agree to be baptized, and in Christmas of 597, Gregory wrote to the Bishop of Alexandria of the mission's success. "For while the nation of the Angli, placed in a corner of the world, remained up to this time misbelieving in the worship of stocks and stones," he exults, "a monk of my monastery proceeded to the end of the world, to the aforesaid nation. And already letters having reached us, telling us of his safety and his work, more than 10,000 Angli are reported to have been baptized. More priests were sent in 601. Ethelbert turned over a wrecked sanctuary in Canterbury to Augustine, to act as his headquarters, and Gregory consecrated Augustine as the Bishop of the Angles at Canterbury. Gregory's epistles preserve the questions that Augustine sent back to him. Should the monks from Rome, trained and long-time Christians, actually live with the converts? The question suggests that the Roman mission had a low opinion of the Saxon people, an attitude Gregory at once condemned. He wrote back, "You ought not to live apart from your new clergy in the Church of the Angli, which by the guidance of God has lately been brought to the faith. Institute that manner of life which in the beginning of the infant church was that of our fathers, among whom none said that any of the things which he possessed was his own, but they had all things in common. The Saxons were converts, which meant that in Gregory's eyes they had become one with the believers in Rome, part of the common Christian cause. The common cause spread slowly. Ethelbert was not Clovis. He did not require his subjects to convert or sponsor any mass baptisms. However, Bede says that he showed great favour and affection to those who did, so that, inevitably, the politically ambitious in the higher classes of society tended to convert. Ethelbert's nephew, king of the East Saxons, accepted Christianity in 604, and the faith began to ripple out into Saxon society. The crimson tide of the cross had begun its slow advance across the island. Chapter 36. The Persian Crusade. Between 589 and 632, a North African becomes emperor. The Persians besiege Constantinople, and new kingdoms of Slavs and Bulgars appear. While Gregory the Great was coping with the Lombards, the Byzantine Emperor Maurice was dealing with the Persians, an ever-present challenge that continually distracted him from the plight of his remaining lands in the west. The first part of his reign had been complicated by Khosrew's son and successor, Hormuz, an ambitious and aggressive young man who spent over a decade battering the Byzantine frontier. The war had been long, dirty, painful, and expensive, and Maurice was tired of it, nor had the war been popular with the Persians. The Persian army had not made any real or permanent gains, and the nobles at the court in Ctesiphon were embarrassed by the stalemate. Hormuz had alienated them even further by trying to woo the Christians in Persia. "Just as our royal throne cannot stand on its two front legs without the two back ones," he had told the Zoroastrians at court, "our kingdom cannot stand or endure firmly if we cause the Christians to become hostile to us." Finally, one of Hormuz's generals revolted against his king. His name was Bahram Chobin, and he had earned a great reputation for himself by beating off a Turkish invasion on the far eastern border. Hormuz, hoping for victory, had then dispatched him to the Byzantine frontier to press the war against Maurice, but in 589, Bahram lost a battle on the banks of the Araxes River to Byzantine forces. Hormuz was furious. He sent his general address to Ware, along with an insulting letter dismissing him from command. Bahram refused to give up his post, so Hormuz sent troops to remove him by force. The troops promptly defected to Bahram's side, and the general marched on Ctesiphon. By the time he got there, the nobles at court had already seized Hormuz, blinded him, he was killed in prison not much later, and put his son Khosrew II on the throne. This was not quite what Bahram had in mind, and he threatened to kill Khosrew II unless the young man relinquished the throne. He had most of the army on his side, so Khosrew II fled from the city, into Byzantine territory. Maurice was the only other king strong enough to fight Bahram, and as soon as Khosrew got across the border, he sent a letter to Constantinople begging Maurice for help. Maurice saw the chance to bring the war with Persia to an end. He sent a Byzantine army back to Ctesiphon with Khosrew II, and after a protracted battle, Bahram was forced out of the city. He fled eastward to the Turks, who first welcomed him and then helped Khosrew II by assassinating him, and Khosrew II took back his throne. In exchange for the help, Khosrew II now agreed to a truce with Maurice and gave him back some of the frontier cities that had been captured decades earlier by the Persians. The two kings sealed the treaty with a marriage. Maurice sent one of his daughters to Ctesiphon to become Khosrew II's wife. As Khosrew II was an inveterate collector of women, one Persian writer insists that he had a harem of 10,000, this was not as meaningful as it might seem. Nevertheless, peace descended over the frontier for the first time in almost 20 years. Finally, Maurice could pay some attention to the west. He still had territories in Italy and North Africa, both under the supervision of the military governors known as exarchs. The exarch in Ravenna had a counterpart in Carthage, both men holding command of such soldiers as Maurice had been able to spare, along with the civil authority to make and enforce laws. He also had a trouble spot on the Danube border. The exarchs were not facing any immediate crises, so Maurice decided to deal with the Danube problem first. The Slavs were now crossing over the river in boats to raid the Byzantine lands on the other side. Maurice began to lead his soldiers to the new battlefield, but halfway to the Danube, he changed his mind and went back to Constantinople. This did not endear him to the men who were being sent far away from home to fight a fierce enemy. The Slavs had begun to take on a frightening Hun-like reputation, refusing to be enslaved or governed, in Maurice's own words, bearing readily heat, cold, rain, nakedness, and scarcity of provisions. Despite his retreat from the front, Maurice had done his research. He wrote a handbook for his men, the Strategikon, describing everything that contemporary generals knew about the Slavs. He warns them to attack in winter if possible, when the trees are bare, since the Slavs are expert at guerrilla tactics and prefer to fight in the deep woods. He tells them to look out for clusters of reeds in the river, since the Slavs might be lying on the bottom, breathing through the hollow stems. He suggests that since the Slavs have multiple chiefs instead of one king, it might be worthwhile trying to bribe some of them to turn against the others. It isn't clear just how useful these tips were, since the Slavs continued to push across the Danube. These invasions were joined by regular assaults from the Avars, who had come up behind them. Fighting on the northwest border of the empire continued for a full 10 years, until the troops were exhausted and battered. Maurice grew more and more unpopular. In 599, the leader of the Avars offered to return 12,000 Byzantine prisoners of war in return for a generous payment. Maurice refused, and the Avars executed all 12,000, which darkened the mood of the army even more. Then, in 602, Maurice, whose treasury must have been all but empty, sent orders to the front. The troops would not be returning home over the winter, as was usual. Rather, to save travel costs and supplies, they would camp across the Danube, foraging in enemy territory for enough food to sustain them. The army refused. Instead, they picked one of their own officers, a man named Phocas, and declared him to be their new general. As his first act, Phocas announced that the army was going home and began to lead the soldiers towards Constantinople. Maurice, who had no friends left in the army, rounded up the blues and greens, armed them, and told them to defend the city against the approaching troops. Apparently, he thought that Phocas intended to take the throne. In fact, the army had sent a letter to Maurice's son and heir, Theodosius, asking him to take the reins of power away from his father. Theodosius had declined, and it is not clear just how much trouble Maurice was in. But he had created a brand new crisis by arming the Blues and the Greens, who, although reduced in number since Justinian's day, were still thugs. They stayed on the walls of the city, behaving like a garrison, for a day and a half, and then started fighting each other. A mob set fire to the house of one of the senators. Rioting spread throughout the city. That night, Maurice decided to flee. He had gout, which made his journey to the harbour slow and painful. With his wife and sons, he finally made it to a ship, and the royal family fled across the strait to the city of Chalcedon. There, Maurice stopped, but he sent his son Theodosius on towards Persia with a letter to Khosrow II, asking him to shelter the Byzantine crown prince in return for the favour Maurice had done for him 10 years earlier. Meanwhile, Phocas had arrived at the city, and the army and the Greens had proclaimed him emperor. The Blues, who were the weaker party, retorted that Maurice was still alive, so another emperor could not be crowned. Phocas decided to remedy this problem. He sent a trusted officer across the water to Chalcedon, where the soldier found Maurice and four of his sons, and murdered all five of them. Another assassin followed young Theodosius on his path towards Ctesiphon, caught up with him in Nicaea, and killed him. The heads of all six men were brought back to Constantinople and staked out for the people to see, remaining on public view until, as the contemporary chronicle of Theophanes tells us, they began to stink. There was a good and practical reason for this. Phocas wanted to make sure that everyone knew Maurice and his heirs were dead. But despite the display, the rumour persisted that Theodosius had made it into Persia and was at the court of Khosrow II. The head of the heir to the throne had been too disfigured for easy identification. At first, Phocas was popular simply because he was not Maurice. The army was relieved to have a military man in charge. The people of Constantinople hoped for change. And Gregory the Great in Rome wrote a fulsome letter welcoming the new emperor to the throne. "Glory to God in the highest," he began, "who changes times and transfers kingdoms. We rejoice that the benignity of your piety has arrived at imperial supremacy. Let the heavens rejoice, and let the earth be glad, and let the whole people of the Republic, hitherto afflicted exceedingly, grow cheerful." Maurice had abandoned Rome, and although Phocas had in turn abandoned the Danube frontier, the land was now in the hands of the Slavs, Gregory hoped for better things from the new emperor. But Phocas immediately fell into another war, this one with Persia. Khosrow II, who had spent the last few years strengthening his control over his empire, saw his chance to expand. He declared war on Phocas, claiming that Theodosius, the son of Maurice, had indeed survived and was with the Persian army. Skirmishes began along the border, and the Persian army crossed the frontier in 605. Khosrow stationed forces in Armenia, invaded Syria, and stormed through Asia Minor. Meanwhile, Phocas, worried about the security of his crown, had been executing possible challengers to the throne left and right. He burned alive the general Narses, who had opposed his reign but who had also been responsible in the past for defeating the Persians. Theophanes says that Persian children shivered when they heard his name, and that the Romans were greatly distressed at his death, but the Persians joyfully exulted. He executed all of Maurice's male relatives, killed the commander of his bodyguard for plotting against him, and then sanctioned the deaths of Maurice's widow and her three daughters. The Greens turned against him, and he reacted by forbidding anyone with Green affiliations to take part in politics. At that point, North Africa rebelled. The leader of the rebellion was none other than the Exarch of Carthage, an old man and a lifelong civil servant who saw the empire crumbling before his eyes. Thracia and Pannonia were gone, and the Persian army was pressing across Asia Minor almost all the way to Chalcedon. In 610, the Exarch assembled a fleet under the command of his son, Heraclius, and sent it towards Constantinople. When the Byzantine commander at Alexandria in Egypt heard of the expedition, he too joined. The combined force sailed into the harbour at Constantinople on October 4th and found the gates open, the people waiting for them, and Phocas already under citizen's arrest. As Heraclius entered the city, Phocas was burned alive in the forum. Heraclius was crowned emperor and found himself at the helm of a mess. He found, Theophanes tells us, that the Roman state had become exhausted, the Avars were devastating Europe, and the Persians had destroyed the Roman army in their battles. There were few veterans left alive among the troops. The Persians, almost unopposed, conquered Edessa and took the city's precious relic, the Mandilion, off to some archive in Ctesiphon. The following year, Caesarea fell into Persian hands as well. Simultaneously, the last remnants of the Western kingdom crumbled. The Visigothic noble, Sisebut, seized the crown of the Visigothic kingdom by force in 612 and began to drive the Byzantines out of the lands they held along the coast of Hispania. He captured the imperial cities along the seaboard and, in the words of the Frankish chronicler Fredegar, razed them to the ground. The slaughter of the Romans by his men caused the pious Sisebut to exclaim, "Woe is me, that my reign should witness so great a shedding of human blood!" His crisis of conscience didn't stretch to giving the land back, though. He had recaptured the peninsula, and the Visigothic kingdom had reached its height of power. Heraclius decided to sue for peace, even if it came on poor terms. He sent envoys to Khosrow II, offering to pay tribute to bring an end to the war. But Khosrow II was winning, and he refused. He had already consolidated his power in the northeast of the Arabian Peninsula by executing the Lakhmid king and annexing his kingdom. In 614, he marched across to the northwest of Arabia and destroyed the power of the Arab Ghassanids, who had helped protect Syria on behalf of Constantinople. He then besieged Jerusalem. The city fell. The Persians, who were irate over the length of the siege, stormed in and massacred the population. "Who can relate the horrors that were seen there?" wrote Antiochus Strategos, who pieced together the story from eyewitness accounts. "They destroyed persons of every age, massacred them like animals, cut them in pieces, mowed them down. Families were herded into the dry moat around the city and put under guard until thirst and heat killed them. In all, nearly 67,000 men, women, and children died under Persian swords. The most precious relic of Jerusalem, a fragment of the true cross, joined the Mandilion in the Persian archives. Once again, Heraclius sued for peace. Once again, Khosrow refused. "I will have no mercy on you," he is reported to have said, "until you renounce him who was crucified and worship the sun." The capture of the true cross had already struck the Byzantines to the heart. It seemed as though divine favor had been entirely lifted from the country. Now the Persians were advancing on Constantinople from the east, while the Avars and Slavs approached from the northwest. The army was exhausted. Grain supplies from North Africa and Egypt had ceased. Heraclius saw no way to save the empire. He loaded all of Constantinople's treasures onto ships, sent them to North Africa for safekeeping, and began to make plans to abandon the city. He would go back to Carthage, the city of his youth, and from there would rule whatever Byzantine territories remained. These plans stayed secret until the ships containing the Byzantine treasure sank in a storm, not too long after leaving the Golden Horn in 618. News of the disaster spread back to the people of the city and caused enormous angst. It had not occurred to them that the situation was so dire, or that Heraclius would ever consider leaving the city to destruction. Their horror was voiced to the emperor by the bishop of Constantinople, the patriarch Sergius, who convinced Heraclius that the defense of New Rome was his sacred duty. At the altar of the Hagia Sophia, Heraclius took a vow before God to stay in the city. Now he was forced to search for a way to dig himself out of an impossible situation. Fortunately for Heraclius, Khosrew II sent him an extremely tactless letter demanding his surrender. "The noblest of the gods, the king and master of the whole earth, to Heraclius, his vile and insensate slave, you say you have trust in God. Why then has he not delivered out of my hand Caesarea, Jerusalem, Alexandria? Are you then ignorant that I have subdued land and sea to my laws, and could I not also destroy Constantinople? But not so. I will pardon all your faults if you will come hither with your wife and children. I will give you lands, vines, and olive groves, which will supply you with the necessaries of life. I will look upon you with a kindly glance. Do not deceive yourself with a vain hope in that Christ, who was not able to save himself from the Jews, that killed him by nailing him to a cross." This letter was a misstep on Khosrew's part. Zoroastrianism was the religion of the aristocrats of Persia, and casting the war as a religious conflict did not make Khosrew's soldiers any more determined. But when Heraclius told the people of Constantinople that the Persians were blaspheming Christ, they were fired with indignation. Men began to join the army in increasing numbers. Sergius, the bishop of Constantinople, melted the treasures of Constantinople's churches, turned them into coins, and presented the money to Heraclius. The war had become a crusade. Heraclius used the church's money to pay and provision new troops, outfit the army with new weapons, and build ships. He also bought a temporary peace with the Avars, protecting his western flank from attack and preventing the necessity of carrying on a two-front war. The Persians, meanwhile, were stalled at Chalcedon. Heraclius had sent his ships to guard the Bosphorus Strait, and the Persians were not quite ready to launch a full naval assault across the water. On Easter Sunday, 622, Heraclius celebrated a solemn Easter Mass at the Cathedral of St. Sophia, taking the Eucharist at the hands of Sergius. The Mass was also a send-off. The next morning, Easter Monday, he departed at the head of his troops, the first Byzantine emperor to ride personally into battle since Theodosius I. He left the bishop Sergius and the city official Bonus in charge of Constantinople, acting as regents for his 10-year-old son Constantine. He did not try to sail straight across to Chalcedon, where the Persians waited. Instead, he ordered the army to be conveyed by ship southward, around the curve of Asia Minor, and landed at the Cilician Gates, the pass through the Taurus Mountains. The mountains protected the troops from immediate attack, and refugees from Syria could land on the shore to join the fight. He spent the summer in Asia Minor, training this army. Apparently, he had scores of men who had never fought before. He found that the army was lazy, cowardly, disorderly, and undisciplined, Theophanes tells us, and so he organized them and taught them how to fight by setting them against each other with wooden swords. It was like seeing the horrible, fearful spectacle without its danger, men converging for murder without bloodshed. Thus, each man got a start from this dangerous slaughter and was more secure thereafter. It was unlikely that this army of baby soldiers would be able to defeat the hardened Persian troops, but Heraclius decided to try. In the fall, he began to march towards Armenia. The Persians were forced to draw away from Chalcedon to meet the challenge. The two armies met somewhere just south of the Armenian border. The exact battlefield is unknown, but Heraclius's men broke the Persian line and drove the Persian army into frantic retreat. Heraclius himself led the attack, leaping forward everywhere and fighting daringly, and his men followed him. Who could have expected the invincible Persian race ever to show its back to the Romans? Theophanes marvels. The tide of the war had turned. For the next 3 years, the Persian advances were slowly wiped out, one at a time, as Heraclius and his men drove the Persians backwards towards Nineveh. The Byzantine army reclaimed Asia Minor and parts of Armenia and Syria. Jerusalem, farther south, remained in Persian hands, but the soldiers were nevertheless fired by the idea that God was with them as they avenged the insult to his son. By 626, Khosrew had decided that it would be necessary to make a drastic move to bring the war to an end. He was ready to besiege Constantinople. He prepared for the assault by doing a little behind-the-scenes diplomacy. He sent an embassy to the Avars, offering friendship on better terms than Heraclius had been able to give, and the Avars agreed to switch sides. They were prized allies, large of stature and proud of spirit, the Russian Primary Chronicle tells us, and Khosrew arranged for them to launch an attack on Constantinople's western walls, while the Persians crossed the water and besieged the east. He reinforced the land attack on the west by buying the loyalty of the Slavs. The Slavs and Avars were not natural allies. In fact, the Avars had started to dominate the Slavs, forcing them to pay tribute and, according to Fredegar, sleeping with their wives and daughters. In 623, a number of unhappy Slavic tribes had united under the leadership of a Frankish merchant named Samo, who had come into the Slavic land north of the Danube to trade. He was apparently a better general than merchant, and he had abandoned his goods in order to lead the Slavs into battle against their Avar overlords. His prudence and courage always brought them victory, Fredegar tells us, and there were more concrete rewards for Samo as well. He had 12 Slavic wives. Samo's kingdom remained hostile to the Avars, but Khosrew II's money convinced at least some of the Slavs to join with their Avar neighbours in the attack on Constantinople. In the last week of July 626, Slavs and Avars marched on the city, while the Persians prepared to sail from the opposite shore. Heraclius and the bulk of the army were far away on the northern Persian border, and defence of the city fell to the remaining soldiers under the command of Bonus